And in the case of, with regards to the energy alternatives and where we go from here, and I'm really happy to, I want to be able to spend a little bit more time talking with you in terms of Dundas and what experiments you've come up with. This transition town experience in the United States, or sorry, in the United Kingdom, is something that I think is one of the great hopeful signs of the future, in the sense that we do have to start at a local level. We can talk about all of these grandiose policies, and yes, we need a national energy policy and strategy in this country that moves us in a transition from the dependence upon fossil fuels to a renewable energy future. But it's where what we do in our local communities and how we go about this is absolutely crucial as a part of that strategy and where things move in the future. And in many ways, that strategy in terms of a national policy needs to be driven by what can happen at the local level. So you asked me the question about local-based economies and how this fits in with the whole question of building an alternative energy future. I say it's a big part of it and a very important part of it. And I just want to salute the work that you seem to be doing in that area and want to learn more from you.
Peter Orman. I just want to make one point about carbon capture. Yeah, if it's only 20% reliable, it's not very something we can really look forward to. And that's the range 20 to 60 or 80%. So it's not the solution everyone's looking for. And also the companies that are benefiting are the ones that are actually producing and they're getting paid to throw the carbon into the ground. And more, they're getting more money than for what they're getting charged to produce the carbon, so it's a net benefit, and that's why they're also spinning that solution. My name is Peter Orman. I actually ran for the Green Party in the last election, and I think that, running in the election is a symptom of the bigger challenge, because I'm sure everyone here has heard about the issues and the solutions 50 or 60 or 70 times. And in 2 weeks, I'm going to be going to Poland. I'm going to the UN conference on climate change. And the thing that's crazy is around the world, there are so many exciting things going on. But there's a bubble within Canada. And we don't understand that we're George Bush and then some right now. So how are we going to burst that bubble?
Okay.
We're going to take two from the same side because David's been waiting for a while. David, go ahead.
Okay. My question is actually about the effect of this oil production on the economy. My understanding is that there's only one country in the world that is a major exporter of natural gas and oil that has avoided the distortion of their economy through the flowing in of this money. And that is Norway. That what Norway has done is to take the royalties and put 95% of them into a fund which can be invested only outside of the country, so as not to overheat the economy, not to have a false supply of revenue that is going to run out. And they have managed to preserve their manufacturing sector and their fishing sector and so on. Now in Canada, we have the problem that resources are under the control of the provinces. And there seems very little political sentiment in Alberta for the Alberta government to do what Norway has done. They're just spending this royalty money like Billy O, and cutting the taxes, et cetera, not thinking about what's going to happen when the stream of royalty stops. Is there any prospect of some kind of national economic policy that would override this, or getting the provincial governments to come to their senses on this issue?
Whew. Okay, again, taking them one at a time. let's go, obviously we'll start with the international level in the sense of the big climate change conferences that are coming up, again, building on everything that had gone back to Kyoto, etc. This new one that's coming up in Poznan, and then followed by that in Copenhagen. And I couldn't agree with you more that that the what one experiences is going on in other countries. It's like we're on another planet altogether in terms of what's happening here in this country. Germany has gone through a major transition, planned transition of their economy to become a more green economy. It's not to say that it's perfect, but they have made a huge investment to move in that direction. The same with regards to the example of Norway that was given in the second question, and I'll come back to that in a few moments. But what I want to say here is that bursting that bubble is going to require the kind of concerted actions that are necessary to take on issues like the tar sands. And we have to link them back into what's happening in our own communities as much as possible. It isn't enough just for us to say that it's an environmental disaster in this country. We also need to recognize that it's also an economic disaster in this country in terms of its impact on the manufacturing sector. And therefore, I think we need to start thinking and talking across these lines between labor and environment to be able to see the connection between these two things and to recognize that this is a common problem that has to be taken on and a common target that needs to be addressed. We have to build resistance against this right across the board. And we have to have resistance that makes sense to us in our own communities as to why we're doing it. It may be because people are concerned about the water and pollution and contamination and draining of water from the Great Lakes that will occur because of some of these refineries in the United States. That may be one part of it. But there are other parts of it too, and we need to link these together and to build much more of a stronger resistance against these kinds of things. We are the black eye of the world. I'm sure. Where's the gentleman from the Green Party? I can't see because of lights. Wherever you are, there you are. I'm sure you know this, that when you go to Bali or any place else, the tar sands is the black mark, and the blot that exists out there, and it's the black blot on Canada. Our international reputation is going down the tubes very rapidly because of what's happening in the tar sands. Therefore, we need to build this resistance up so that people like you can take those stories to those international circles and say, there are Canadians standing up and there are Canadians saying, we don't want this and we want to stop it and we need this international solidarity and help to be able to make it pull that off. I think that's the kind of thing we've got to do. The flip side of that, in some ways, is the comment about and the question about Norway. It is really true that what has gone on in Norway is a much better model than what we have. Much better planning and care for the entire economy and planning around it, whether it's on the one hand pooling capital for future needs and future development that is in the interests of the people of Norway and internationally, or whether it's about looking at the impact upon the manufacturing sector and not allowing the overheating of the economy. All of those things have been important steps that Norway has taken. It is interesting to note that in the OECD report of late last year, the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, warned Canada about the tar sands and what was happening in terms of its economic impacts and its environmental impacts. And it said very clearly, you ought to look at what's going on in Norway because it's a better model, and that's a model you should be following in terms of what is happening in this country. So what I'm saying is that there are other observers out there out in other countries that are looking in on the Canadian scene and recognizing the distortions that we have talked about this evening and have been amplified by the comment that was made by our friend over here on this. As to, clearly we need to start developing much clearer strategies and proposals on this. We need to be saying to the political parties across the board, you've got to look at the total impact of the tar sands and start developing new kinds of strategies and new kinds of proposals for dealing with these challenges in the near future. And start making that transition to a sustainable energy and economic future. That's what we have to do, I think. and we need to push the political parties to go much further than they have up until this present time. Green Party, perhaps notwithstanding.
Very good. How about two more sets? There's been two ladies standing here, and these two folks. If you can go over and line up over there, because the microphone here seems dead. So we'll have two more sets. First set.
I'll try to be brief. Thanks very much for coming, and I think it's great that in a time... Can you guys hear me? No. Okay, I'm just thinking it's great that in a time where we're all online all the time, that we all came out to actually discuss this in person, and thank you so much for setting that up. I just wanted to continue on the idea of solutions that might reach people that aren't in this room, that maybe don't aren't motivated purely by environmental concerns, and the economic aspects of your argument are great for that. And also connecting to the Saskatchewan comments from before, that I know one of the concerns for a lot of people these days is health risks associated with projects like this. And I think there was a study done in September in Alberta that surveyed close to 1,000 Albertans on their feelings on the tar sands, and while 3 out of 10 of them were concerned about the environmental damage, I think 7 out of 10 of them were concerned about the health impacts. And I know I haven't read your book yet, but I promise I will, that you comment a bit on baseline studies for cancer rates and things like that. I'm wondering if you have any idea if there's a lot more research going on about that that people can access.
I actually have two questions. One is about the comment.
Stay on tiptoes and be brief.
So I actually have two questions and a comment. I'll start with the comment. We're having a conference. We're starting to organize it for mid-March at McMaster, and it's going to be based on the tar sands. So we're welcoming any suggestions. Anybody who wants to get involved, I'll be outside afterwards, so you can tag it on the list. My two questions. The first one is, in terms of transitioning to a greener economy, do you any collaboration between alternative energy developers? Collaboration between alternative energy suppliers and developers in terms of lobbying the Canadian government to switch to a greener economy? And then the other question I had was, how do you suggest that we challenge the power and arrogance of oil companies out of Alberta?
Were those? That was two, right?
That's actually three.
Yeah, right. Okay, very quickly then, because the evening's pouring, I'm moving on. To the question about baseline studies on health and health impacts, I do sort of speak to that in the book to some extent. There is a Dr. Timoney who has done some fairly serious work on health impacts of what the tar sands have done in terms of the contamination of the water systems and the deformation of both fish and wildlife and humans, and the cancer rates themselves. So all of that some of that, I should say, is indicated there. And I think from there you can find more information than I was able to lay out in the book itself, because obviously I didn't want to spend a lot of time covering everything. The other thing is that in regards to the question of, is there, for moving towards a greener economy, some examples of collaboration taking place? I think that there are. I know that there are, but it would take a little bit more time, I think, for us to kind of walk through some of those examples. We're seeing some early stages of this collaboration between, for example, some people involved in the labor movement and some people involved in the environment movement. We're seeing in the States the blue-green alliances and coalitions that are being put together. Which is a phenomenon that's evolving in the United States and is spilling over into Canada. And I think we're going to see more of that in the future. But I would have to go into more detail about some of the people and the contacts that might be useful in that regard. As far as taking on the oil companies is concerned, You know, they're the biggest behemoths, the biggest corporations, the biggest transnationals in the world, really. When you talk about ExxonMobil or Phillips Conoco or Shell Oil or British Petroleum or any of those, I mean, these are big, big corporations. But people have been fighting them, you know, in other parts of the world, and have had varying degrees of success in stopping them from their operations. And I think we have to start biting the bullet here and starting to recognize that we too have to knuckle under and start to take on these big corporations. And that's exactly what we're trying to do with the tar sands fight. We're going to be taking it to them in a variety of different ways over the next few years. And you're going to see some skirmishes going to take place around pipelines and pipeline expansion. You're going to see some skirmishes taking place and fights taking place around refineries. You're going to see some skirmishes taking place around the depletion and contamination of water sources. You're going to see some fights and battles take place with the federal government involved in the process and fighting them too around the greenhouse gas emissions, but all in many ways aimed at putting pressure on these oil companies to stop what they are doing. It's time we did it, and it's time we organized, and there can't be a better issue for Canadians to do this than around the tar sands, and I'll leave it at that. Okay?
Okay, last time. Go ahead.
Thank you so much for taking the time to answer our question. So there's these skirmishes that are happening, but there's, like, the industry is full of people who are there because they went to school to become engineers and they're doing something they love. There's people who have debt or they have a cell phone to pay and they're working because they can make $20 an hour moving buckets of sludge. There's people who have investments. There's people who manage investments. There's all of these things that are tied up in it. We pride our Canadian economy in growth in terms of GDP. And I'm hoping that you can speak to that skirmish, the skirmish of all the good that comes out of it. I don't believe in that. but there's, like, a lot of good, like, people are able to raise families because of the tar sands. I'll leave it with that. Thank you.
Okay, last question.
That's great, because my question is sort of a follow-up question. I guess I'm wondering how we move beyond seeing this as an economic issue, because ultimately it's an environmental issue. And I heard you speak last week just about how we have this water crisis happening right now throughout the world, and Canada does have some of the freshest amounts of water in the world. I believe 1/3% of the world's fresh water being fresh water sources. And also we have an abundance of natural resources that we seem to be destroying every single day with this project. So I guess the first question is, how do we move beyond seeing this as an economic issue when really we don't have an environment, we don't have an economy, we don't have our livelihood? So, and it sort of ties into that, I guess, how we try to remove people's fears about the economy, because I even know several people who have lost their jobs this week, and it seems like the tar sands is such a viable option to go and make very large amounts of money and have that security back to them. But meanwhile, you're again feeding into this monster machine that's just destroying the environment. How do you address the concerns of people's fears?
Good question. Come on up here and answer it a little bit more. No, I don't treat that either of those questions lightly. They're really serious questions, and I think that when it comes to, I've been taking them each, you know, when they've come up, okay, and I'll come back to yours in a minute. But whenever you take on an industry, whenever you take on a corporation as big as what, an industry as big as what we're dealing with here, especially when it's moved into the center of our economy, as I've been arguing, etc., a lot of people are involved. A lot of people are affected. You're absolutely right. And one of the problems is that people have very strong vested interests tied up in preserving all of that and not having it knocked down. But, you know, that is the challenge I think that we are really faced with today, and that is that we can't go about that in a glib way. We have to take people seriously who have made a real commitment to that particular industry and are really, you know, working and gaining from it, etc., and they're keeping their families fed and housed as a result of it, and so forth. And I don't treat that lightly, but I think that what we need to do is have conversation with people in an intelligent way about what is going on here. And you know, when you do that, you find that some people start to change. We have found that, for example, we have seen geologists and engineers who have worked with the oil companies begin to see that this is a vicious circle and it's going to end up nowhere if we continue doing what we're doing. And we have to continue dialoguing and helping people see that as best we can. And at the same time, that should not slow us down on the kind of resistance that we need to put up against the atrocities that are going on in the name of that industry. Dialogue is important as a part of any kind of process, in my view, of social change. Dialogue with the people on both sides of the fence is important. But at the same time, resistance is also important, and we have to show that resistance when it's really necessary to do so. So it's finding the right kind of balance on that. It's finding a way of dialoguing and talking with people who are so intimately affected by the decisions that we or anybody else would make with regards to the future of that industry. For example, we work with one of the unions, the Communication Energy and Paper Workers, who represent the workers in the tar sands. They've got a tough job ahead of them. They know that there's something really fundamentally wrong with this industry, but they can't suddenly move in and propose that it be stopped and shut down because all of their members are directly affected. But at the same time, they're trying to find ways of opening up discussion and debate about this so that people can understand what really is at stake here. Do we really want our children and our grandchildren to inherit this kind of industry in tar sands mega machine in the future? Do we really want that to happen? Or do we want to start intelligently now making a transition? And this is where the green jobs movement is going to be really important, coming up with some viable green job plans and strategies so that there can be a hard look at an industry like this. Talk about a transition, a job transition strategy that's really effective and real. And I think these are the kind of conversations we're trying to open up with people who represent workers in the industry itself. So I just want to say that, you know, that's the best I can do right now in terms of where we're trying to move on this. With regards to the final question, insofar as I understood it, I agree that the environmental impact of what is happening in the tar sands is paramount. Totally agree with that. And I can go on and on and on about that, and you can too. But we're living in a climate where people's fear is also generated by the economic crisis. So somehow we have to find a way of talking and working with people around the environmental impacts in a way that also means something to them in terms of how they're addressing the environment, the economic challenges that they're up against. And that's why I think that as we talk about this in this part of the country, in Hamilton and in southwestern Ontario, where the manufacturing sector has almost been gutted, and I argue in large measure because of what we have seen in the tar sands and the overheating of the economy and the role that the dollar has played, spiked by the by high oil prices, all of that is linked. And while it is true we have to make that transition into a sustainable environmental future, we also have to build a sustainable economy for the future. And we're only going to learn this if we take moments like this and try to work at the issues at hand. Just as the manufacturing sector is being dismantled to some extent in this part of the country, we've got to talk about a new future, a new kind of green job strategy, a new kind of economic future for people, and we've got to work at it. So I think eventually we do have to bring the economy and the environment together in a new way. You may disagree with that, but that's where I stand. Okay? And I've run out of steam.
I'd like to call on David Cohen to thank Tony Clark. David is a former Dundas town councillor back when Dundas was a town, and is a journalist, a Mohawk College instructor, and an avowed urbanist. David.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasant task to perform this duty. I think that I found this talk somewhat disquieting, but I was certainly very grateful for Mr. Clark's great erudition, his wonderful presentation organized beautifully, so that in the end, something very hopeful I found was sounded in this presentation. So on behalf of the spirit of Red Hill, I'd like to present this token of our appreciation, which may help you relax.
Could I ask, I'd like a colleague of mine, Joe Cressy, to come up here and to give you an idea of some of the things that we are suggesting and proposing for action workshops, in the hopes that some people may be of interest, have an interest in participating in the follow-up to this evening, not right away, but in the next couple of months, through the possibility of an action workshop addressing the tar sands and the actions that could need to be taken.
Sure. Listen, everybody, I'll be very quick. I know it's late and there's been a lot of information thrown at us. My name is Joe Cressy. Tony's my boss. That's the quick story. But
No boss at all.
Just very quickly, the tar sands, as we've heard, it's a pretty big issue. It's an issue which transcends constituencies. It deals with the environment. It deals with labor. It deals with impacted communities like First Nations. And as Tony said, across the country, mobilizations are being planned. The resistance has started. Last week, we met as a group of 15 organizations from across the country to map out the next 5 years, not the next 5 months. It's a growing movement. And I want to invite all of you to join in this. I want, first of all, to invite you to visit www.tarsandswatch.org. That's tarsandswatch.org, to find more information, to get involved, to take action. But also, I want to invite you, when you're there, to keep your eye out and to sign up for action-oriented workshops, which are being planned across the country. These are going to be teach-ins and workshops which go into communities to amplify the voices of communities and to work with them to make this a truly national issue and not an Alberta issue, which is too often viewed as. So I'm going to stop it there. Tony, thanks so much. And thanks to all of you. And let's get home, and the movement starts tomorrow.
Thank you, Joe. It would not be a book tour without a plug for the book, an excellent book by Tony Clark, Tar Sands Showdown. It is on sale in the lobby by Joanna Chapman, formerly of Chapman Books, but still selling books. And $20 will buy you this wonderful book. And $5 of that $20 will go to the Spirit of the Red Hill Valley lecture series. So an investment in this enterprise to bring this to Hamilton in perpetuity. You could also pick up a copy of Dundas, Ontario in Transition, Do It, at Joanna's stand. That is free. You can pick that up. I would all, at the very last, I would like to call upon Joan Roberts,